handiwork. He'd taken to drawing on the walls with the smoke from one of the candles, enhancing the marks with his chalks. Hoi Polloi was much impressed, and her laughter, the first Jude had ever heard from the girl, followed her out into the hallway, where she found Clem standing guard beside the locked front door. They stared at each other in the candlelight for several seconds before she said, "Do you feel it too?"
"Yep. It's not very pleasant, is it?"
"I thought it was only me," she said.
"Why only you?"
"I don't know, some kind of punishment."
"You still think he's got some secret agenda, don't you?"
"No," Jude said, glancing up the stairs. "I think he's doing what he believes is best. In fact, I know it. Uma Umaga Magi got inside his head.
God, he hated that."
"She gave him a good report, whether he hated it or not."
"So?"
"So there's still a conspiracy somewhere."
"Sartori?"
"No. It's something to do with their father and this damn reconciliation." She winced as the discomfort in her belly became more severe. "I'm not afraid of Sartori. It's what's going on in this house," she gritted her teeth as another wave of pain passed through her system, "that I can't quite trust." She looked back at Clem and knew that, as ever, he'd listen as a loving friend, but she could expect no support from him. He and Tay were the angels of the reconciliation, and if she pressed them to decide between her welfare and that of the working, she'd be the loser. The sound of Hoi Polloi's laughter came again, not as feathery as before, but with an undertow of mischief Jude knew was sexual. She turned her back on the sound, and on Clem, and her gaze came to rest on the door of the one room in this house she'd never entered. It stood a little ajar, and she could see that candles were burning inside. Of all the company to seek out when she was in need of comfort, Celestine's was the least promising, but all other avenues were closed to her. She crossed to the door and pushed it open. The mattress was empty and the candle beside it was burning low. The room was too large to be illuminated by such a fitful flame, and she had to study the darkness until she found its occupant. Celestine was standing against the far wall.
"I am surprised you came back," she said.
Jude had heard many exquisite speakers since she'd last heard Celestine, but there was still something extraordinary in the way the woman mingled voices, one running beneath the other, as though the part of her touched by divinity had never entirely married with the baser self.
"Why surprised?"
"Because I thought you'd stay with the goddesses."
"I was tempted," Jude replied.
"But finally you had to come back, for him."
"I was a messenger, that's all. I've got no claims on gentle now."
"I didn't mean gentle."
"I see.
I
know who you meant.
Can't you bear to have his name spoken?"
Celestine had been staring at the candle flame, but now she looked up at Jude.
"What will you do when he's dead?" she asked. "He will die. You realize that? He has to. Gentle will want to be magnanimous, the way victors are supposed to be. He'll want to forgive all his brother's trespasses, but there'll be too many demands for his head."
Until now, Jude hadn't contemplated the possibility of Sartori's demise. Even in the tower, knowing Gentle had gone in pursuit of his brother intending to stop his malice, she'd never believed he'd die. But what Celestine said was undoubtedly true. There were countless claims upon his head, both secular and divine. Even if Gentle was forgiving, Jokalela wouldn't be, nor would the Unbeheld.
"You're very alike, you know, you and he," Celestine said. "Both copies of a finer original."
"You never knew Quaiswa," Jude replied. "You don't know whether she was finer or not."
"Copies are always coarser. It's their nature. But at least your instinct's good. You and he belong together. That's what you're pining for, isn't it? Why don't you admit it?
Why should I pour out my heart to you?
Isn't that what you came in here to do? You won't get any sympathy out there.
Listening by the door now?
I've heard everything that's gone on in this house since I was brought here, and what I haven't heard, I felt, and what I haven't felt, I've predicted."
"Like what?"
"Well, for one thing, that child Monday will end up coupling with the little virgin you brought back from Isorderex."
"That scarcely takes an oracle.
And the Oviat isn't long for this world."
"The Oviat?"
"It calls itself Little Ease. The beast you had under your heel. It asked the maestro to bless it a little while ago. It'll murder itself before daybreak."
"Why would it do that?"
It knows when Sartori perishes, it'll be forfeit too, however much allegiance it's sworn to the winning side. It's sensible. It wants to choose its moment. Am I supposed to find some lesson in that? I don't think you're capable of suicide, Celestine said.
You're right. I've got too much to live for.
Motherhood
and the future. There's going to be a change in this city. I've seen it in Isordarex already. The waters will rise,
and the great sisterhood will dispense love from on high.
Why not? Clem told me what happened when the goddess came. You were in ecstasies, so don't try and deny it.
Maybe I was. But do you imagine that's going to make you and me sisters? What have we got in common besides our sex?
The question was meant to sting, but its plainness made Jude see the questioner with fresh eyes. Why was Celestine so eager to deny any other link between them but womanhood? Because another such link existed, and it was at the very heart of their enmity. Nor, now that Celestine's contempt had freed Jude from reverence, was it difficult to see where their stories intersected. From the beginning, Celestine had marked Jude out as a woman who stank of coitus. Why? Because she, too, stank of coitus. And this business with the child, which came up again and again, that had the same root. Celestine had also borne a baby for this dynasty of gods and demigods. She, too, had been used and had never quite come to terms with the fact. When she raged against Jude, the tainted woman who would not concede her error in being sexual, in being fecund, she was raging against some fault in herself. And the nature of that fault? It wasn't difficult to guess or to put words to. Celestine had asked a plain question. Now it was Jude's turn.
Was it really rape? She said.
Celestine glanced up, her look venomous. The denial that followed, however, was measured.
I'm afraid I don't know what you mean, she said.
Well, now, Jude replied, how else can I put it?
She paused.
Did Sartori's father take you against your will?
The other woman now put on a show of comprehension, followed by one of shock.
Of course he did, she said. How could you ask such a thing?
But you knew where you were going, didn't you? I realized Aud drugged you at the start, but you weren't in a coma all the way across the Dominions. You knew something extraordinary was waiting at the end of the trip.
I don't remember.
Yes, you do. You remember every mile of it. And I don't think Dowd kept his mouth shut all those weeks. He was pimping for God, and he was proud of it, wasn't he?
Celestine offered no riposte. She simply stared at Jude, daring her to go on, which Jude was happy to do.
So he told you what lay ahead, didn't he? He said that you were going to the Holy City, and you were going to see the Unbeheld himself. Not just see him, but be loved by him. And you were flattered.
It wasn't like that.
How was it, then? Did he have his angels hold you down while he did the deed? No, I don't think so. You lay there, and you let him do what the hell he wanted, because it was going to make you into the bride of God and the mother of Christ.
Stop!
If I'm wrong, tell me how it was. Tell me you screamed and fought and tried to tear out his eyes.
Celestine continued to stare, but said nothing.
That's why you despise me, isn't it?
Jude went on.
That's why I'm the woman who stinks of coitus, because I lay down with a piece of the same God that you did, and you don't like to be reminded of the fact.
Don't judge me, woman! Celestine suddenly shouted.
Then don't you judge me, woman! I did what I wanted with the man I wanted, and I'm carrying the consequences. You did the same. I'm not ashamed of it.
You are!
That's why we're not sisters, Celestine.
She'd said her piece, and she wasn't much interested in a further round of insults and denials, so she turned her back and had her hand on the door when Celestine spoke. There were no denials. She spoke softly, half lost to memory.
It was a city of iniquities, she said. But how was I to know that? I thought I was blessed among women to have been chosen to be God's bride,
Jude said, turning back from the door.
That's a kind word, Celestine said. Yes, bride. She drew a deep breath. I never even saw my husband.
What did you see?
Nobody. The city was full. I know it was full. I saw shadows at the window. I saw them close up the doors when I passed, but nobody showed their faces.
Were you afraid?
No. It was too beautiful. The stones were full of light, and the houses were so high you could barely see the sky. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. And I walked, and I walked, and I kept thinking, he'll send an angel for me soon, and I'll be carried to his palace. But there were no angels. There was just the city going on and on in every direction, and I got tired after a time. I sat down, just to rest for a few minutes, and I fell asleep.
You fell asleep?
Yes. Imagine. I was in the city of God, and I fell asleep. And I dreamed I was back at Tyburn, where Dowd had found me. I was watching a man being hanged, and I dug through the crowd until I was standing under the gallows. She raised her head. I remember looking up at him, kicking at the end of his rope. His breeches were unbuttoned, and his rod was poking out. The look on her face was all disgust, but she drove herself on to finish the story. And I lay down under him. I lay down in the dirt in front of all these people, with him kicking, and his rod getting redder and redder, and as he died, he spilled his seed. I wanted to get up before it touched me, but my legs were open, and it was too late. Down it came. Not much, just a few spurts. But I felt every drop inside me like a little fire, and I wanted to cry out, but I didn't, because that was when I heard the voice.
What voice?
It was in the ground underneath me, whispering.
What did it say?
The same thing over and over again. Nisi Nirvana. Nisi Nirvana. Nisi Nirvana. In the process of repeating the words, tears began to flow copiously. She made no attempt to stem them, but the repetition faltered.
Was it Hypaxamendios talking to you? Jude asked.
Celestine shook her head. Why should he speak to me? He had what he needed. I'd lain down and dreamed while he dropped his seed. He was already gone, back to his angels.
So who was it?
I don't know. I've thought about it over and over. I even made it into a story to tell the child, so that when I'd gone, he'd have the mystery for himself. But I don't think I ever really wanted to know. I was afraid my heart would burst if I ever knew the answer. I was afraid the heart of the world would burst. She looked up at Jude. So now you know my shame, she said.
I know your story, said Jude, but I don't see any reason for shame.
Her own tears, which she'd been holding back since Celestine had begun to share this horror with her, fell now, flowing a little for the pain she felt and a little for the doubt that still churned in her, but mostly for the smile that came onto Celestine's face when she heard Jude's reply, and for the sight of the other woman opening her arms and crossing the room, to embrace her like a loved one who'd been lost and found again, before some final fire.
Chapter 23 1 If coming to the moment of reconciliation had been for Gentle a series of rememberings, leading him back to himself, then the greatest of those rememberings, and the one he was least prepared for, was the reconciliation itself. Though he'd performed the working before, the circumstances had been radically different. For one, there'd been all the hoopla of a grand event. He'd gone into the circle like a prize fighter, with an air of congratulation hanging around his head before he'd even worked up a sweat, his patrons and admirers a cheering throng at the sidelines. This time he was alone. For another, he'd had his eyes on what the world would shower on him when the work was done, what women would fall to him, what wealth and glory would come. This time, the prize in sight was a different thing entirely, and wouldn't be counted in stained sheets and coinage. He was the instrument of a higher and wiser power. That fact took the fear away.
When he opened his mind to the process, he felt a calm come upon him, subduing the unease he'd felt climbing the stairs. He'd told Jude and Clem that forces would run through the house, the likes of which its bricks had never known, and it was true. He felt them fuel his weakening mind, ushering his thoughts out of his head to gather the dominion to the circle. That gleaning began with the place he was sitting in. His mind spread to all compass points, and up and down, to have the sum of the room. It was an easy space to grasp. Generations of prison poets had made the analogies for him, and he borrowed them freely. The walls were his body's limits, the door his mouth, the windows his eyes. Commonplace similitudes, taxing his power of comparison not a jot. He dissolved the boards, the plaster, the glass, and all the thousand tiny details in the same lyric of confinement, and, having made them part of him, broke their bounds to stray farther afield. As his imagination headed down the stairs and up onto the roof, he felt the beginnings of momentum. His intellect, dogged by literalism, was already lagging behind a sensibility more mercurial, which was delivering back to him similitudes for the whole house before his logical faculties had even reached the hallway. Once again, his body was the measure of all things. The cellar, his bowels. The roof, his scalp. The stairs, his spine. Their proofs delivered, his thoughts flew out of the house, rising up over the slates and spreading through the streets. He gave passing consideration to Sartori as he went, knowing his other was out here in the night somewhere, skulking. But his mind was quicksilver, and too exhilarated by its speed and capacity to go searching in the shadows for an enemy already defeated. With speed came ease. The streets were no more difficult to claim than the house he'd already devoured. His body had its conduits and its intersections, had its places of excrement and its fine, dandified facades, had its rivers moving from a springing place, and its parliament, and its holy seat. The whole city, he began to see, could be analogized to his flesh, bone, and blood, and why should that be so surprising? When an architect turned his mind to the building of a city, where would he look for inspiration? To the flesh, where he'd lived since birth. It was the first model for any creator. It was a school and an eating house and an abattoir and a church. It could be a prison and a brothel and bedlam. There wasn't an edifice in any street in London that hadn't begun somewhere in the private city of an architect's anatomy, and all Gentle had to do was open his mind to that fact, and the districts were his, running back to swell the assembly in his head. He flew north, through Highbury and Finsbury Park, to Palmer's Green and Cockfosters. He went east, with the river past Greenwich, where the clock that marked the coming of midnight stood, and on towards Tilbury. West took him through Marylebone and Hammersmith, south through Lambeth and Streatham, where he'd first met Pi O'Pa long ago. But the names soon became irrelevant. Like the ground seen from a rising plain, the particulars of a street or a district became part of another pattern, even more appetizing to his ambitious spirit. He saw the Wash glittering to the east, and the Channel to the south, becalmed on this humid night. Here was a fine new challenge. Was his body, which had proved the equal of a city, also the measure of this vaster geography? Why not? Water flowed by the same laws everywhere, whether the conduit was a groove in his brow or a rift between the continents, and were his hands, not like two countries, laid side by side in his lap, their peninsulas almost touching, their landscapes scarred and grooved. There was nothing outside his substance that was not mirrored within, no sea, no city, no street, no roof, no room. He was in the fifth, and the fifth in him, gathering to be carried into the Anna as a proof and a map and a poem, written in praise of all things being one. In the other dominions, the same pursuit of similitude was underway. From his circle on the Mount of Lipabayak, Tik Raw had already drawn into his net of dissolution both the city of Patashokwa and the highway that ran from its gates towards the mountains. In the third, Skopeek, his fears that the absence of the pivot would invalidate his working allayed, was spreading his grasp across the Quem towards the dust bowls around Maike In Limby, where he was soon to arrive, there were celebrants gathering at the temples, their hopes raised by prophetics who'd appeared from hiding the night before to spread the word that the reconciliation was imminent. No less inspired, Athanasius was presently travelling back along the Lenten Way to the borders of the Third and skimming the ocean to the islands, while a self more tender trod the changed streets of his Ordorex. He found challenges there unknown to Scopeek, Tick Raw, or even Gentle. There were slippery wonders loose on the streets that defied easy analogy. But in inviting Athanasius to join the synod, Scopeek had chosen better than he knew. The man's obsession with Christos, the bleeding god, gave him a grasp of what the goddesses had wrought that a man less preoccupied by death and resurrection would never have owned. In his Ordorex's ravaged streets, he saw a reflection of his own physical ravagement, and in the music of the iconoclastic waters, an echo of the blood that ran from his wounds, transformed, by love of the Holy Mother he had worshipped, into a sublime and healing liquor. Only Chickajackeen at the borders of the First Dominion had to work with abstractions, for there was nothing of a physical nature he could win similitudes from. All he had was the blank wall of the erasure to set his mind on. Of the dominion that lay beyond, which it fell to him to encapsulate and carry into the Anna, he had no knowledge. He hadn't spent so many years studying the mystery without finding some means to tussle with it, however. Although his body offered no analogy for the enigma that lay on the other side of the divide, there was a place in him just as sealed from sight, and just as open to the inquiries made by dreaming explorers like himself. He let mind, the unbeheld process that empowered every meaningful action, that made the very devotion that kept him in his circle, be his similitude. The blank wall of the erasure was the white bone of his skull, scoured of every scrap of meat and hair. The force inside, incapable of impartial self-study, was both the god of the First and the thoughts of Chickajackeen, bonded by mutual scrutiny. After tonight, both would be free of the curse of invisibility. The erasure would drop, and the godhead come back into view to walk the Imagica. When that happened, when the same godhead who'd taken the Nullianacs into his furnace and burned their malice away was no longer divided from his dominions, there would be a revelation such as had never been known before. The dead, trapped in their condition and unable to find the door, would have a light to lead the way. And the living, no longer afraid to show their minds, would step from their houses like divinities, carrying their private heavens upon their heads for all to see. About his own work, Gentle had little grasp of what his fellow maestros were achieving, but the absence of alarm from the other dominions reassured him that all was well. All the pains and humiliations he'd endured to reach this place had been repaid in the little hours since he'd stepped into the circle. An ecstasy he'd only known for the duration of a heartbeat suffused him, confounding the conviction he'd had that such feelings only came in glimpses because to know them for longer would burst the heart. It wasn't so. The ecstasy went on, and he was surviving it. More than surviving, burgeoning, his authority over the working stronger with every city and sea he retrieved into the circle where he sat. The Fifth was almost there with him now, sharing the space, teaching him with its coming where the true power of a reconciler lay. It wasn't a skill with fates and sways, nor was it numas, nor resurrections, nor the driving out of demons. It was the strength to call the myriad wonders of an entire dominion by the names of his body, and not be broken by the simile. To allow that he was in the world to its smallest degree, and the world in him, and not be driven to insanity by the intricacies he contained, or else so enamoured of the panoramas he was spread through that he lost all memory of the man he'd been. There was such pleasure in this process that laughter began to shake him as he sat in the circle. His good humour wasn't a distraction from his purpose, but instead made it easier still. His laugh lightened thoughts, running from the circle out to regions both bright and benighted, and coming back with their prizes like runners sent with poems to a promised land, and returning with it on their backs.
flowering as it came.
2. In the room above, little Ease heard the laughter and capered in sympathy with the liberatore's joy. What else could such a sound mean but that the deed was close to being done? Even if it didn't see the consequences of this triumph, it thought, its last night in the living world had been immeasurably sweetened by all it had been a party to. And should there be an afterlife for such creatures as itself, although of this it was by no means certain, then its account of this night would be a fine tale to tell when it went into the company of its ancestors. Anxious not to disturb the reconciler, it gave up its dance of celebration and was about to return to the window and its duties as night watchman when it heard a sound its paddings had concealed. Its gaze went from the sill to the ceiling. The wind had got up in the last little while and was skittering across the roof, rattling the slates as it went. Or so Ease thought, until it realized the tree outside was as still as the Quem at equinox. Little Ease didn't come from a tribe of heroes. Quite the reverse. The legends of its people concerned famous apologists, humblers, deserters, and cowards. Its instinct, hearing this sound from above, was to be away downstairs as fast as its bandy legs knew how. But it fought what came naturally for the reconciler's sake, and cautiously approached the window in the hope of gaining a glimpse of what was happening above. It climbed up onto the sill and, belly up, slid itself out a little way, peering up at the eaves. A mist dirtied the starlight and the roof was dark. It leaned a little farther out, the sill hard beneath its bony back. From the window below, the sound of the reconciler's laughter floated up, its music reassuring. Little Ease had time to smile, hearing it. Then something as dark as the roof and as dirty as the fog that covered the stars reached down and stopped its mouth. The attack came so suddenly, Little Ease lost its grip on the window frame and toppled backwards. But its smotherer had too tight a hold on it to let it drop, and hauled it up onto the roof. Seeing the assembly there, Ease knew its errors instantly. One, it had stopped its nostrils, and so failed to smell this congregation. Two, it had believed too much in a theology which taught that evil came from below. Not so. Not so. While it had watched the street for Sartori and his legion, it had neglected the route along the roofs, which was just as secure for creatures as nimble as these. There were not more than six of them, but then there didn't need to be. The Gekagek were feared among the feared, oviats that only the most overweening of maestros would have called into the dominions. As massive as tigers and as sleek, they had hands the size of a man's head and heads as flat as a man's hand. Their flanks were translucent in some lights, but here they had made a pact with darkness, and they lay, all but the smotherer, at the apex of the roof, their silhouettes concealing the maestro until he rose and murmured that the captive be brought to his feet. "Now, little Ease," he said, the words too soft to be heard in the rooms below, but loud enough to make the creature evacuate its bowels in terror. I want you to spill more than your shite for me. 3. It gave Sartori no satisfaction to watch Little Ease's life go out. The sense of exhilaration he'd felt at dawn when, having summoned the Gekagek, he'd contemplated the confrontation that lay a few hours off, had been all but sweated out of him by the heat of the intervening day. The Gekagek were powerful beasts and might well have survived the journey from Shiverick Square to Gamut Street, but no oviat was fond of the light from any heaven, and rather than risk their debilitation, he'd stayed beneath the trees with his pride, counting off the hours. Only once had he ventured from their company and had found the streets deserted. The sight should have heartened him. With the area deserted, he and the creatures would be unwitnessed when they moved on the enemy. But sitting in the silent bower with his dozing legion, undistracted by even the sound of a fly, his mind had been preyed upon by fears he'd always put away until now, fears fueled by the sight of these empty streets. Was it possible that his revisionist purposes were about to be overwhelmed by some still greater revision? He realized his dreams of a new Isordarex were valueless. He'd said as much to his brother in the tower.
but even if he wasn't to be an empire builder here, he still had something to live for. She was in the house in Gamut Street, yearning for him, he hoped, as he yearned for her. He wanted continuance, even if it was as hell to gentle's heaven. But the desertion of this city made him wonder if even that was a pipe dream. As the afternoon had crept on, he'd begun to look forward to reaching Gamut Street simply for the signs of life it would provide, but he'd arrived to find precious little comfort here. The phantoms that lingered at the perimeters only reminded him of how uncharitable death really was, and the sounds that issued from the house itself, a girl's giggling from one of the lower rooms, and later full-throated laughter, his brother's from the meditation room, only seemed to him signs of an idiot optimism. He wished he could scour these thoughts from his head, but there was no escape from them except, possibly, in the arms of his Judith. She was in the house, that he knew, but with the currents unleashed inside so strong, he dared not enter. What he wanted, and what he finally got from Little Ease, was intelligence as to her state and whereabouts. He had assumed, wrongly as it turned out, that Judith was with the Reconciler. She'd taken herself off to Isorderex, Little Ease said, and come back with fabulous tales, but the Reconciler had not been much impressed by them. There'd been a fracas, and he'd begun his work alone. Why had she gone in the first place? He inquired, but the creature claimed it didn't know and could not be persuaded to supply an answer, even though its limbs were half twisted off and its brain pan opened to the Gekagek's tongue. It had died protesting its ignorance, and Sartori had left the pride to toy with the carcass, taking himself off along the roof to turn over what he'd learned. Oh, for a wad of Crouchy, to subdue his impatience, or else make him brave enough to beat on the door and tell her to come out and make love among the phantoms. But he was too tender to face the currents. There'd come a time, very soon, when the Reconciler, his gathering completed, would retire to the Anna. At that juncture, the circle, its power no longer needed as a conduit to carry the analogues back into its reservoir, would turn off those currents and turn its attention to conveying the Reconciler through the Innovo. There, in that window between the Reconciler's removal to the Anna and the completion of the working, he would act. He'd enter the house and let the Gekagek take Gentle, and any who rose to protect him, while he claimed Judith. Thinking of her, and of the Crouchy he yearned for, he brought the blue egg out of his pocket and put it to his lips. He'd kissed its cool 1,000 times in the last few hours, licked it, sucked it. But he wanted it deeper inside him, locked up in his belly as she would be when they'd mated again. He put it in his mouth, threw back his head, and swallowed. It went down easily, and granted him a few minutes of calm while he waited for the hour of his deliverance. Had Clem's head not had two tenants, he might well have forsaken his place at the front door during the hours in which the Reconciler worked above. The currents which that process had unleashed had made his belly ache at the outset, but after a time their effect mellowed, suffusing his system with a serenity so persuasive he'd wanted to find a place to lie down and dream. But Tay had policed such dereliction of duty severely, and whenever Clem's attention strayed, he felt his lover's presence, which was so subtly wed and interwoven with his thoughts it only became apparent when there was a conflict of interests, rousing him to fresh vigilance. So he kept his post, though by now it was surely an academic exercise. The candle he had set beside the door was drowning in its own wax, and he had just stooped to wick the lip and let the excess flow off, when he heard something hitting the step outside, the sound like that of a fish being slapped on a slab. He gave up his candle work and put his ear to the door. There was no further sound. Had a fruit fallen from the tree outside the house, he wondered, or was there some stranger rain tonight? He went from the door through to the room where Monday had been entertaining Hoi Polloi. They'd left it for some more private place, taking two of the cushions with them. The thought that there were lovers in the house tonight pleased him, and he silently wished them well as he crossed to the window. It was darker outside than he'd expected, and though he had a view of the step, he couldn't distinguish between objects lying upon it and the designs that Monday had drawn there.
Perplexed rather than anxious, he went back to the front door and listened again. There were no further sounds, and he was tempted to let the matter alone, but he half hoped some visionary rain had indeed begun to fall, and he was too curious to ignore the mystery. He moved the candle from the door, the wax snuffing the flame as he did so. No matter. There were other candles burning at the bottom of the stairs, and he had sufficient light to find the bolts and slide them back. In Celestine's room, Jude woke and raised her head from the mattress where she'd laid it an hour before. The conversation between the women had continued for some while after their peacemaking, but Jude's exhaustion had finally caught up with her, and Celestine had suggested she rest for a while, which, reassured by Celestine's presence, she'd gladly done. Now she stirred to find that Celestine had also succumbed, her head on the mattress, her body on the floor. She was snoring softly, undisturbed by whatever had woken Jude. The door was slightly ajar, and a perfume was coming through it, stirring a faint nausea in Jude's system. She sat up and rubbed at the crick in her neck, then got to her feet. She'd slipped off her shoes before she lay down, but rather than search for them in the darkened room, she went out into the hallway barefoot. The smell was much stronger now. It was coming from the street outside, its route plain. The front door was open, and the angels who'd been guarding it were gone. Calling Clem's name, she crossed the hallway, her step slowing as she approached the open door. The candles at the stairs were bright enough to shed some light upon the step. There was something glistening there. She picked up her speed again, asking for the goddesses to be with her and with Clem. "Don't let this be him," she murmured, seeing that it was tissue glistening and blood in a pool around it. "Please don't let this be him." It wasn't. Now that she was almost at the threshold, she saw the remnants of a face there and knew it. Sartori's agent, Little Ease. Its eyes had been scooped out, and its mouth, which had spewed pleas and flattery in such abundance, was tongueless. But there was no doubting its identity. Only a creature of the Inovo could still twitch as this did, refusing to give up the semblance of life even if the fact of it had gone. She looked beyond the trophy into the murk of the street, calling Clem's name again. There was no answer at first. Then she heard him, his shout half smothered.
"Go back inside! For God's sake, go back!"
"Clem?" She stepped out of the house, bringing new cries of alarm from the darkness.
"Don't! Don't!"
"I'm not going back without you," she said, avoiding the Oviat's head as she advanced. She heard something let out a soft sound as she did so, like a creature growling with its maw full of bees.
"Who's there?"
she said. There was no reply at first, but she knew it would come if she waited, and whose voice it would be when it did. She did not anticipate the nature of the reply, however, or its falling note. "It wasn't supposed to happen this way," Sartori said.
"If you've hurt Clem—"
"I've no wish to hurt anybody." She knew that was a lie. But she also knew he'd do Clem no harm as long as he needed a hostage.
"Let Clem go," she said.
"Will you come to me if I do?" She left a decent pause before replying, so as not to seem too eager.
"Yes," she said. "I'll come."
"No, Judy," Clem said. "Don't! He's not alone!"
She could see that now, as her eyes became more accustomed to the darkness. Sleek, ugly beasts prowled back and forth. One was up on its back legs, sharpening its claws on the tree. Another was in the gutter, close enough for her to see its innards through its translucent skin. Their ugliness didn't distress her. Around the fringes of any drama, such detritus was bound to accrue. Scraps of discarded characters, soiled costumes, cracked masks. They were irrelevances, and her lover had taken them for company because he felt a kinship with them. She pitied them. But him, who'd been most high, she pitied more.
"I want to see Clem here on the step before I make a move," she said.
There was a pause, then Sartori said, "I'm going to trust you." His words were followed by further sounds from the Oviats that paced in the murk, and Jude saw two of them slope out of the shadows with Clem between them, his arms in their throats.
They came close enough to the pavement for her to see the foam of appetite that rose from their lips. Then they literally spat their prisoner free. Clem fell face down on the road, his hands and arms covered in their muck. She wanted to go to his aid there and then, but though the captors had retreated, the tree gouger had turned and lowered its shovel head, its eyes, black as a shark's, flickering back and forth in their bulbous sockets, hungry to have the frail meat on the road. If she moved, she feared it would pounce, so she kept her place on the step while Clem hauled himself to his feet. His arms were blistered by the Oviatt's spittle, but he was otherwise intact.
"I'm all right, Judy," he murmured. "Go back inside."
She stayed put, however, waiting until he was up and staggering across the pavement before she started down the steps.
"Go back," he told her again.
She put her arms around him and whispered,
"Clem, I don't want you to argue with this. Go into the house and lock the door. I'm not coming with you."
He started to speak, but she hushed him.
"No argument," I said. "I want to see him, Clem. I want to be with him. Now, please, if you love me, go inside and close the door."
She felt reluctance in his every sinew, but he knew too much about the business of love, especially love that defied orthodoxy, to attempt to reason with her.
"Just remember what he's done," he said, as he let her go. "That's all part of it, Clem," she said, and slipped past him.
It was easy to leave the light behind. The ache which the currents had woken in her marrow diminished with every yard she put between herself and the house, and the thought of the embrace ahead quickened her step. This was what she wanted, and what he wanted too. Though the first causes of this passion were gone, one to dust, one to divinity, she and the man in the darkness were its embodiments, and could not be denied each other. She glanced back towards the house once only to see that Clem was lingering on the step. She didn't waste time trying to persuade him to go inside, but simply turned back to the shadows.
"Where are you?" she said.
"Here," her lover replied, and stepped from the folds of his legion. A single strand of luminescent matter came with him, fine enough to have been woven by Oviatt spiders, but clotted here and there with beads, like pearls, which swelled and dropped from the filaments, running down his arms and face and mottling the ground where he walked. The light flattered him, but she was too hungry for the truth of his face to be deceived, and piercing the glamour with her stare found him much reduced. The shining dandy she'd first met in Klein's plastic garden had gone. Now his eyes were heavy with despair, his mouth drawn down at the corners, his hair awry. Perhaps he'd always looked like this, and he'd simply used some piffling sway to mask the fact, but she doubted it. He was changed on the outside because something had changed within. Though she stood before him defenceless, he made no move to touch her, but hung back like a penitent in need of invitation before he approached the altar. She liked this new fastidiousness.
"I didn't hurt the angels," he said softly.
"You shouldn't even have touched them."
"It wasn't supposed to happen like this," he said again. "The Gekagek were clumsy. They dropped some meat from the roof."
"I saw."
"I was going to wait until the power subsided and come for you in style."
He paused, then asked, "Would you have let me take you?"
"Yes."
"I wasn't certain. I was a little afraid you'd reject me, and then I'd become cruel. You're my sanity now. I can't go on without you."
"You went on all those years in his order, Rex."
"I had you there," he said, "only by a different name."
"And you were still cruel."
"Imagine how much crueler I would have been," he said, as if amazed at the possibility, "if I hadn't had your face to mellow me."
"Is that all I am to you? A face?"
"You know better than that," he said, his voice dropping to a whisper.
"Tell me," she said, inviting his affections.
He glanced back over his shoulder towards the legion. If he spoke to them, she didn't hear it. They simply retreated, cowed by his glance. When they were gone, he put his hands to her face,
his little fingers just beneath the line of her jaw, his thumbs laid lightly at the corners of her mouth. Despite the heat that was still rising from the cooked asphalt, his skin was chilly. "One way or another," he said, "we don't have very long, so I'll keep this simple. There's no future for us now. Maybe there was yesterday, but tonight..."
"I thought you were going to build a new Isorderex."
"I was. I have the perfect model for it here." His thumbs went from the corners of her mouth to the middle of her lips and stroked them. "A city made in your image, built in place of these miserable streets."
"But now?"
"We don't have the time, love. My brother's about his work up there, and when he's finished..." He sighed, his voice dropping lower still. "When he's finished."
"What?"
she said. There was something he wanted to share, but he was forbidding himself. "I hear you went back to Isorderex," he said. She wanted to press him to complete his earlier explanation, but she knew better than to push too hard, so she answered him, knowing his earlier doubts could surface again if she was patient. Yes, she said, she had indeed been to Isorderex, and she'd found the palace much changed. This sparked his interest. "Who's taken it over?" "Not Rosengarten."
"No."
"The Dirthers, that damn priest Athanasius."
"None of those."
"Who then?"
"Goddesses."
The web of luminescence fluttered around his head, shaken by his distress.
"They were always there," she told him.
"Or at least one was. A goddess called Uma Umagamagai.
Have you ever heard of her?"
"Legends."
"She was in the pivot."
"That's impossible," he said. "The pivot belongs to the unbeheld. The whole of Imagica belongs to the unbeheld." She'd never heard of a breath of subservience in him before, but she heard it now.
"Does he own us too?" she asked him.
"We may escape that," he said, "but it'll be hard, love. He's the father of us all. He expects to be obeyed, even to the very end." Again, an aching pause, but this time a request on its heels. "Will you embrace me?" he asked her. She answered with her arms. His hands slid from her face and through her hair to clasp behind her. "I used to think it was a godlike thing to build cities," he murmured, "and if I built one fine enough, it would stand forever. And so would I. But everything passes away sooner or later, doesn't it?" She heard in his words a despair that was the inverse of Gentle's visionary zeal, as though in the time she'd known them they'd exchanged their lives. Gentle, the faithless lover, had become a dealer in heavens, while Sartori, the sometime maker of hells, was here holding out love as his last salvation.
"What is God's work?" she asked him quietly, "if it's not the building of cities?"
"I don't know," he said.
"Well, maybe it's none of our business," she said, pretending a lover's indifference to matters of moment. "We'll forget about the unbeheld. We've got each other. We've got the child. We can be together for as long as we like."
There was enough truth in these sentiments, enough hope in her that this vision might come true, that using it for manipulative purpose sickened her. But having turned her back on the house and all it contained, she could hear in her lover's whispers echoes of the same doubts that had made her an outcast, and if she had to use the feelings between them as a way to finally solve the enigma, so be it. Her queasiness at her deceit wasn't soothed by its effectiveness. When Sartori let out a tiny sob, as he did now, she wanted to confess her motives. But she fought the desire and let him suffer, hoping that he'd finally purge himself of all he knew, even though she suspected he'd never dared even shape these thoughts before, much less speak them. "There'll be no child," he said. "No being together."
"Why not?"
she said, still striving to keep her tone optimistic.
"We can leave now if you want. We can go anywhere and hide anywhere."
"There are no hiding places left," he said.
"We'll find one."
"No,
There are none.
He drew away from her. She was glad of his tears. They were a veil between his gaze and her duplicity.
I told the reconciler I was my own destroyer, he said. I said I saw my works and I conspired against them. But then I asked myself, whose eyes am I seeing with? And you know what the answer is? My father's eyes, Judith. My father's eyes.
Of all the voices to return into Jude's head as he spoke, it was Clara Leash's she heard. Man the destroyer, willfully undoing the world, and what more perfect manhood was there than the God of the First Dominion?
If I see my works with these eyes and want to destroy them, Sartori murmured, what does he see? What does he want?
Reconciliation, she said.
Yes, but why? It's not a beginning, Judith. It's the end. When the Imagicus whole, he'll turn it into a wasteland.
She drew away from him.
How do you know?
I think I've always known.
And you said nothing? All your talk about the future?
I didn't dare admit it to myself. I didn't want to believe I was anything but my own man. You understand that. I've seen you fight to see with your own eyes. I did the same. I couldn't admit he had any part of me until now.
Why now?
Because I see you with my eyes. I love you with my heart. I love you, Judith. And that means I'm free of him. I can admit what I know.
He dissolved in grief, but his hands kept hold of her as he shook.
There's nowhere to hide, love, he said. We've got a few minutes together, you and I. A few sweet moments, then it's over.
She heard everything he said, but her thoughts were as much with what was going on in the house behind her. Despite all she'd heard from Uma Umagamagai, despite the zeal of the maestro, despite all the calamities that would come with her interference, the reconciliation had to be halted.
We can still stop him, she said to Sartori.
It's too late, he replied. Let him have his victory. We can defy him in a better way, a purer way.
How?
We can die together.
That's not defying him. It's defeat.
I don't want to live with his presence in me. I want to lie down with you and die. It won't hurt, love.
He opened his jacket. There were two blades at his belt. They glittered by the light of the floating threads, but his eyes glittered more dangerously still. His tears had dried. He looked almost happy.
It's the only way, he said.
I can't.
If you love me, you will.
She drew her arm from his grasp.
I want to live, she said, backing away from him.
Don't desert me, he replied.
There was warning in his voice as well as appeal.
Don't leave me to my father. Please. If you love me, don't leave me to my father. Judith!
He drew the knives out of his belt and came after her, offering the handle of one as he came, like a merchant selling suicide. She swiped at the proffered blade, and it went from his grasp. As it flew, she turned, hoping to the goddess that Clem had left the door open. He had, and lit every candle he could find, to judge by the spill of light onto the step. She picked up her pace, hearing Sartori's voice behind her as she went. He only spoke her name, but the threat in it was unmistakable. She didn't reply. Her flight from him was answer enough, but when she reached the pavement, she glanced back at him. He was picking up the dropped knife. And rising.
Again, he said, Judith!
But this time it was a warning of a different order. Off to her left, a motion drew her glance. One of the Gekagek, the sharpener, was coming at her, its flat head now wide as a manhole and toothed to its gut. Sartori yelled an order, but the thing was rogue and came on at her unchecked. She raced for the step, and as she did so, heard a whoop from the door. Monday was there. Naked but for his grimy underwear, in his hand a homemade bludgeon which he swung around his head like a man possessed. She ducked beneath its sweep as she made the step. Clem was behind him, ready to haul her in, but she turned to call Monday to retreat, in time to see the Gekagek mounting the step in pursuit. Her defender didn't retreat, but brought the weapon down in a whistling arc, striking the Gekagek's gaping head. The bludgeon shattered, but the blow sheared off one of the beast's bulbous eyes. Though wounded, its mass was still sufficient to carry it forward, and one of its freshly honed claws found Munday's back as he turned to dodge it. The boy shrieked and might have fallen beneath the Oviat's attack if Clem hadn't grabbed his arms and all but thrown him into the house. The half-blinded beast was a yard from Jude's feet, its head thrown back as it raged in pain. But it wasn't the Moor she was watching. It was Sartori. He was once again walking towards the house, a knife in each hand and a Gekagek at each heel. His eyes were fixed on her. They shone with sorrow. "In!" Clem yelled, and she relinquished both sight and step to pitch herself back over the threshold. The one-eyed Oviat came after her as she did so, but Clem was fast. The heavy door swung closed, and Hoi Polloi was there to fling the bolts across, leaving the wounded beast and its still more wounded master out in the darkness. On the floor above, Gentle heard nothing of this. He had finally passed, via the Circle's good offices, through the Innovo and into what Pai had called the Mansion of the Nexus, the Anna, where he and the other maestros would undertake the penultimate phase of the working. The conventional life of the senses was redundant in this place, and for Gentle being here was like a dream in which he was knowing but unknown, potent but unfixed. He didn't mourn the body he'd left in Gamut Street. If he never inhabited it again, it would be no loss, he thought. He had a far finer condition here, like a figure in some exquisite equation that could neither be removed nor reduced, but was all it had to be, no more, no less, to change the sum of things. He knew the others were with him, and though he had no sight to see them with, his mind's eye had never owned so vast a palette as it did now, nor had his invention ever been finer. There was no need for cribbing and forgery here. He had earned, with his metempsychosis, access to a visionary grasp he'd never dreamt of possessing, and his imagination brimmed with correlatives for the company he kept. He invented Tik Raw, dressed in the motley he'd first seen the man wear in Vanayaf, but fashioned now from the wonders of the Fourth. A suit of mountains, dusted in Jokale Laurian snow, a shirt of Patashokwa, belted by its walls, a shimmering halo of green and gold, casting its light down on a face as busy as the highway. Skopeek was a less gaudy sight, the grey dust of the Quem billowing around him like a shredded coat, its particles etching the glories of the Third in its folds. The cradle was there. So were the temples at Limby. So was the Lenten Way. There was even a glimpse of the railroad track, the smoke of its locomotive rising to add its murk to the storm. Then Athanasius, dressed in a clout of dirty cloth and carrying in his bleeding hands a perfect representation of his Isorderex, from the causeway to the desert, from the harbour to Ipse. The ocean ran from his wounded flank, and the crown of thorns he wore was blossoming, throwing petals of rainbow light down upon all he bore. Finally, there was Chika Jackeen, here in lightning, the way he'd looked 200 midsummers before. He'd been weeping then, and waxen with fright, but now the storm was his possession, not his scourge, and the arcs of fire that leapt between his fingers were a geometry austere and beautiful, that solved the mystery of the first, and in unveiling it made perfection the new enigma. Inventing them this way, Gentle wondered if they in turn were inventing him, or whether his painter's hunger to see was an irrelevancy to them, and what they imagined, knowing he was with them, was a body subtler than any sight. It would be better that way, he supposed, and with time he'd learn to rise out of his literalisms, just as he'd shrug off the self that wore his name. He had no attachment to this Gentle left, nor to the tale that hung behind. It was tragedy, that self, any self. It was a marriage made with loss, and had he not wanted one last glimpse of Pai Opa, he might have prayed that his reward for reconciliation would be this state in perpetuity. He knew that wasn't plausible, of course. The Anna's sanctuary existed for only a brief time, and while it did so, it had more ecumenical business than nurturing a single soul.
The maestros had served their purpose in bringing the dominions into this sacred space and would soon be redundant. They would return to their circles, leaving dominion to meld with dominion, and in so doing drive the Inovo back like a malignant sea. What would happen then was a matter of conjecture. He doubted there'd be an instant of revelation. All the nations of the Fifth waking to their unfettered state in the same moment? It would most likely be slow, the work of years. Rumours at first that bridges wreathed in fogs could be found by those eager enough to look, then the rumours becoming certainties, and the bridges becoming causeways, and the fogs great clouds, until, in a generation or two, children were born who knew without being taught that the species had five dominions to explore and would one day discover its own godhood in its wanderings. But the time it took to reach that blessed day was unimportant. The moment the first bridge, however small, was forged, the Imagicka was whole. And at that moment every soul in the Dominion, from cradle to deathbed, would be healed in some tiny part and take their next breath lighter for the fact. Jude waited in the hall long enough to be sure that Monday wasn't dead. Then she headed towards the stairs. The currents which had induced such discomforts were no longer circling in the system of the house, sure sign that some new phase of the working, possibly its last, was underway above. Clem joined her at the bottom of the stairs, armed with another two of Monday's homemade bludgeons.
"How many of these creatures are there out there?" he demanded.
"Maybe half a dozen."
"You'll have to watch the back door, then,"
he said, thrusting one of the weapons at Jude.
"You use it,"
she said, pressing past him. "Keep them out for as long as you can."
"Where are you going?"
"To stop Gentle."
"Stop him? In God's name, why?"
"Because Dowd was right. If he completes the reconciliation, we're dead."
He cast the bludgeons aside and took hold of her.
"No, Judy," he said. "You know I can't let you do that."
It wasn't just Clem speaking, but Tay as well. Two voices and a single utterance. It was more distressing than anything she'd heard or seen outside, to have this command issue from a face she loved, but she kept her calm.
"Let go of me,"
she said, reaching for the banister to haul herself up the stairs.
"He's twisted your mind, Judy,"
the angels said.
"You don't know what you're doing."
"I know damn well,"
she said, and fought to wrest herself free. But Clem's arms, despite their blistering, were unyielding. She looked for some help from Monday, but he and Hoi Polloi had their backs to the door, against which the Gekagek were beating their massive limbs. Stout as the timbers were, they'd splinter soon. She had to get to Gentle before the beasts got in, or it was all over. And then, above the din of assault, came a voice she'd only heard raised once before.
"Let her go."
Celestine had emerged from her bedroom draped in a sheet. The candlelight shook all around her, but she was steady, her gaze mesmeric. The angels looked around at her, Clem's hands still holding Jude fast.
"She wants to—"
"I know what she wants to do," Celestine said. "If you're our guardians, guard us now. Let her go."
Jude felt doubt loosen the hold on her. She didn't give the angels time to change their mind, but dragged herself free and started up the stairs again. Halfway up, she heard a shout and glanced down to see both Hoi Polloi and Monday thrown forward as the door's middle panel broke and a prodigious limb reached through to snatch at the air.
"Go on,"
Celestine yelled up to her, and Jude returned to her ascent as the woman stepped onto the bottom stair to guard the way. Though there was far less light above than below, the details of the physical world became more insistent as she climbed. The flight beneath her bare feet was suddenly a wonderland of grains,